What the hell is tax reform anyway?
How do I maximize my super?
How does the exchange rate impact me?
What is negative gearing?
How can I stay out of debt?
What is a housing bubble anyway?
ASX, S&P, WTF?
Welcome to On The Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks and big bickies.
On The Money, serving up finance in one easy bite.
Hello and welcome to On The Money. I'm Catherine Zengerer. On the show this week,
a more meaningful, a more informed, a more evidence-based debate, but unfortunately it doesn't look like we've had that to date and we need to have it sometime soon.
The government no longer uses the slogan debt and deficit disaster, but what does that mean? Does that mean the deficit is no longer a problem? We speak to one group who believes it is. Also on the show,
it's sort of one of these areas where you can see where a lot of the problems are, but finding neat solutions is much more difficult.
How do we get a global agreement on eradicating tax avoidance? That's all coming up. You're on the money. The troubled Whyalla Steel and Mining Group, Arrium, went into voluntary administration today following failed discussions with lenders. The move puts at risk thousands of jobs. Burdened by a massive $2.1 billion debt, Arrium, a former BHP Billiton subsidiary, anchors the economy of Whyalla and the entire Spencer Gulf industrial region of South Australia. The future for Australia's manufacturing and building industries look bleak if Arrium is allowed to collapse. There were hopes that the government would step in to help the company, but that doesn't seem to have happened. Let's have a listen to what Industry Minister Christopher Pyne had to say today.
The use of taxpayers' funds in a bailout is a very blunt instrument when there are other levers that the government can and has been pulling and could potentially pull in the future to support a business like this.
Meanwhile, opposition leader Bill Shorten was keen to capitalise on the issue, saying a Labor government would introduce a policy requiring Australian steel to be used on Australian government projects.
A Labor government I lead would make sure that we had genuine local procurement. Governments at all levels, council, state and federal government, spend a lot of money on infrastructure. What's wrong with requiring Australian content in the steel?
To find out what the implications are of Arrium folding, we are joined on the line now by Professor John Spear. He is Director of the Australian Industrial Transformation Institute. Welcome to the program, John.
Good to be with you, Catherine.
Do you agree with the Minister, Christopher Pyne, that the government stepping in and bailing out Arrium is a blunt instrument?
Well, look, I think all options need to be on the table at the moment, and there has been discussion in South Australia about the possibility that the state government might provide a financial contribution, a so-called co-contribution, if you like, to upgrading the facilities in Whyalla. And the federal government hasn't ruled that out. So it's a bit of a movable feast at the moment. It might be necessary for both the state and the federal government to come to the party in terms of upgrading some very, very ageing blast furnaces at the Whyalla plant, and that's one of the large capital investments that Arrium faces going forward.
I guess what Christopher Pyne might have been hinting at there is that there were some other measures that the government could take. He talked about some other levers that he thought might be less of a so-called blunt instrument. What kind of things was he perhaps hinting at, do you think?
Well, there are a range of measures that are very important as part of an overall package for trying to ensure the survival of Arrium. One of them is to try and bring forward major projects that have a high level of steel content in them, and the federal government has done that through its major rail project in the Upper Spencer Gulf that it's bringing forward, which is a very substantial rail project that will increase demand for Arrium steel, and that's very welcome. But there are a range of, I think, other other projects and other procurement measures that might need to be put in place to really provide the pipeline of projects that ARIM needs over the next 4 or 5 years.
Are you talking here, for example, about the federal government developing a procurement policy that says all federal government construction jobs will use Australian-bought steel?
Yeah, essentially. Nick Xenophon's been advocating for this, and I've talked about it quite a lot here in South Australia recently. There is a need, I think, for the states and the federal government to strike a deal around this, which is a commitment to ensuring that all major government-funded projects, whether or not they're federal government or state-funded projects, have a provision in them that we use only Australian accredited Australian standard steel.
That would be an election-pleasing announcement, wouldn't it?
I think so, absolutely. Wyala, or town of Wyala, and indeed the whole Upper Spencer Gulf region at the moment is feeling very anxious, very nervous about what's ahead. And so measures like this would help. But that alone, though, is not going to save ARIM.
Okay. What would the impact be on the town of Wyala and indeed on the steel manufacturing industry in Australia if ARIM was to fold?
Well, it's nationally, of course, it would deprive us of a major steel producer, one of the only ones we've got in this country. So losing that capacity and capability is a real problem for the nation. And, of course, for Wyala and the region, it's devastating because there's really a very substantial number of jobs associated with both the mine and... sorry about my dog in the background.
The beauty of live radio. The dogs are baying for ARIM
and,
steel.
So 3,000 jobs at stake and possibly up to 6,000 jobs on top of that. So, and there's an unemployment rate of around about 7.4% already in Wyala.
Okay, so how quickly would some kind of procurement policy make a difference, though, for ARIM? Say, for example, if the government did go down the path of not stepping in with some kind of bailout package, but if they did offer something like a procurement policy, is that going to come into effect quickly enough for ARIM to make a difference?
Well, that'll make a difference, I think, in terms of the attitude of the major banks, remembering that four of the major banks are owed about $1 billion from ARIM at the moment, or at least lent ARIM about $1 billion. So that means that they need some assurances that ARIM's likely to be able to trade its way out of its difficulties at the moment. And if it's got assurances around procurement, then that would help to, I think, boost confidence amongst the banks.
Do we have any kind of time frame from the voluntary administrators on, when they would need those kinds of assurances by, so that I guess the future of the jobs of those workers is made more clear?
Well, it's a pretty structured process going forward. The administrators have to meet with the creditors, and it'll take a little while for the administrators to understand what the financial position is of ARIM and what are viable options, but. We're not talking about weeks here, we're probably talking about months before it's resolved.
Okay, well, as the South Australian Premier Jay Weatherall said, this is the beginning of a long and difficult path forward for the Wyala community by the sounds of things.
Oh, it certainly is, and unfortunately this is all occurring on the back of course, the impending closure of the auto industry in Australia and in South Australia, so this is a double whammy for South Australia.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us with your view, John Speer.
Yeah, good to be with you, Catherine.
John Speer is a director of the Australian Industrial Transformation Institute based in South Australia, joining us there from South Australia, along with his dog, by the sound of things. You're on the Money.
On the Money, dishing the dirt on your dough.
When Malcolm Turnbull took over the Prime Ministership in September last year, he promised a new economic narrative. Part of that was his shift away from the language of debt and deficit disaster favoured by his predecessor, Tony Abbott. But a report from the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia, known as CEDA, released recently, says returning to surplus should be a priority for the government. And they say that it's possible to do by 2018-19, that's much earlier than government predictions. Andrew Barclay spoke to Stephen Martin, Chief Executive of CEDA, to find out why they believe achieving surplus is so important for the Australian economy.
CEDA believes that, unfortunately, both sides of politics have tended to push out the time frame in terms of which they could undertake some budget repair. And we think that that is, in fact, disadvantaging the Australian community and the Australian people more generally, because it means that unless the budget deficit is brought under control now, some of the more important and significant initiatives in reform, perhaps around taxation reform, dealing with questions in terms of health funding and disability funding and education funding, are going to be pushed further and further out. And so our report, in fact, has said there is a way in which the federal budget can be brought into balance in 18-19, and that subsequent to that, it can in fact be in surplus. And this then gives the government of the day plenty of opportunity to tackle the other significant reform issues that it wants to do.
In the report there, you say that there are quite a few politically palatable measures the government could pursue. Why do you think they're not taking them?
The problem at the moment, I suspect, is more around election timing, the fact that there is a question around some aspects of leadership. I think the fact is that the government has been looking for particular initiatives that it wanted to pursue, but perhaps some of the strategies that it's used to do that have fallen foul of state premiers or other reasons. The simple fact is, for example, that Tony Abbott, when Prime Minister, promised that there was going to be a white paper on federation and there was going to be a white paper on taxation. Both of those were quite critical because clearly federation would define what level of government had responsibility for what. Maybe that would include an examination of taxation. And certainly the taxation white paper was going to do that. Now, both of those were swept away. Unfortunately, they have not been put on the table again. And political pressure has seen any number of options, particularly around taxation reform, simply disappear.
And what do you say to those who argue that we should take advantage of historically low interest rates to fund big infrastructure projects, which could potentially increase the budget deficit?
Look, what is of concern is that the government has an excellent AAA credit rating, and yet it seems low to use that, particularly, as you suggest, in borrowing funds that could then be injected into significant infrastructure projects. The view would be, however, that if there was I understand that there is a discussion paper that's either out or coming out shortly that will be tackling this. There is a view that suggests that in fact, is an argument that is not sustainable, that, in fact, the government could use its AAA credit rating, it could borrow the money, but it could be an equal partner with the private sector in investing in infrastructure. Now, these are things that need to be examined in further detail.
That's a public-private partnership you're emphasizing there.
These public-private partnerships have been around for a long time, and I suspect it's probably an enhancement of that that's being considered.
In the report, you mentioned that there's some space there for some corporate tax reform. Do you think, given the revelations of the Panama Papers this week, that that's going to be possible, especially with the optics around giving a potential company tax cut?
In terms of corporate tax rate, again, this is one of those issues which I think is likely to go the way of GST and other taxation reform issues that are dealt with in isolation. Simply, they'll be swept away because the politics is a little bit too difficult. Our view, of course, would have been that having a genuine and detailed taxation reform policy debate that saw a green paper emerge and a white paper emerge and salesmanship on behalf of the government supplement that to convince the Australian people as to why taxation reform might be necessary, whether it be about indirect taxes, whether it be about company taxes, whether it be about states giving up some of their taxing powers, whether it be about states reforming things like payroll taxes and so on. All of those should have been on the agenda some time ago, but unfortunately they're not. Now, we recognise that that's the case, and so when we've looked at what suggestions we have about taxation reform, we've taken what some might consider to be the easy road, and that is that tobacco taxes and alcohol tax might be the ones that are considered to raise revenue for the government. We've also talked about the concessions around superannuation and some of these other issues which both sides of politics have been talking about. So again, reinforcing the view that we are saying, as a principle, the budget deficit is a major and massive problem. We have had 25 years of continuous economic growth, and yet for the last 8 years, we have had a budget deficit at the federal level that is getting bigger. And each year, the government, at their half-yearly review or in their budget, pushes out when it's going to be back in balance by yet another year. And we are saying, by these different measures that we've put in there, you can come up with a program of initiatives that will get that budget back into balance without too many problems.
I'd like to get your thoughts on the tax discussion so far. Christopher Payne came out and said last week was a messy week for the government. What do you think of it?
Look, I think one of the issues that did emerge last week, and Christopher Payne was probably right to say it was messy, was the fact that if you are proposing major change, you have to prepare the groundwork. And clearly the state premiers did not believe that they had been prepared appropriately. If the state governments are going to give up some issues of taxation or some of the powers that they have and then be given a percentage of Commonwealth government taxation powers, they need to model these things themselves. They need to know what it will mean for their bottom line, and there's a fair bit of work that goes into that. Now, I understand that some of these matters have been around and under consideration privately for some time, but I'm not sure that having it released as part of a COAG agenda the day before it was going to have that meeting is the way to go if you expect to take people with you. All of these will be the sorts of issues that should have a more meaningful, a more informed, a more evidence-based debate, but unfortunately it doesn't look like we've had that to date, and we need to have it sometime soon.
CEO of CEDA, that's the Committee for Economic Development of Australia, Stephen Martin. He was speaking with On the Money reporter Andrew Barclay. That's just part of our series of special budget coverage here on the Money. If you would like to hear more of our budget coverage, looking at what the various players and stakeholders in the budget 2016 have had to say, why not go to our website? It's 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can find all of our stories there, including all of our special budget coverage in the lead up to this budget, which will be 1 week earlier this year on the 3rd of May. This is On the Money, serving up finance in one easy bite, wherever you are around the country. Thanks so much for joining us. Hello, if you're listening in Taree on 2 Bob Radio, if you're listening in Sydney on 2 SER, or if you're listening on 8CCC in Alice Springs. And a big hello to you if you are listening to us on our podcast. Why not give us a review? You can subscribe to our podcast now on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. Well, the Panama Papers detailing the tax avoidance and money laundering strategies of companies and individuals has rocked the world. But the question is, what can governments realistically do about it? Around the world, tax avoidance is estimated as being worth US $240 billion every year. And that's probably underestimated. Here in Australia, the best guess is that we're missing out to the tune of US $1.5 billion. At the Global Forum on Tax Transparency, 47 countries agreed to a common reporting standard on the automatic exchange of tax information. But this is a voluntary agreement and doesn't cover the transactions of companies or of individuals on their own soil. And here in Australia, it seems the ATO's ability to be effective in tracking tax dodging practices hasn't been all that we'd hoped. For his view on the situation, I caught up with Professor John Taylor. He's head of the School of Taxation and Business Law at the University of New South Wales.
It'd be fair to say that
in the international corporate restructuring space. The ATO hasn't been all that successful in applying the general anti-avoidance rule there. There were some significant amendments following after they lost a couple of major cases.
What we're hearing from our government, we've heard the Treasurer say on this that our record when it comes to tax avoidance and particularly multinational tax avoidance is one of legislation and one of action. Would you agree with that?
They've done some things. They amended the general anti-avoidance rule last year, and we do have reasonably rigorous rules, for example, on how much debt you can put into an Australian subsidiary. But there's also holes all over the place. We don't have anything much by way of rules on how much royalties you can pay out of an Australian subsidiary, for example. We do have fairly sophisticated transfer pricing rules, which were amended reasonably recently. So, I think on the whole, our system is a highly sort of developed system, but there are holes in it. We also have a system that basically doesn't provide any sort of real incentive for a foreign multinational to pay tax here, and doesn't provide any incentive for our multinationals to pay tax anywhere else.
Now, this is part of the problem, isn't it, that we can make laws for companies here in Australia, but what about foreign entities that aren't controlled by Australian laws?
Exactly.
Can we make any effective laws about that?
We tend to make rules limiting interest deductibility, for example, of some, that try to eliminate the amount of base erosion that happens, or transfer pricing rules try to eliminate or reduce profit shifting. But there's all sorts of steps on the way that make that difficult. There's nothing much that we can do to require a tax haven, for example, to change its rules.
A number of countries agreed to a common reporting standard, but the problem is that that isn't a mandatory standard. And if some countries have signed up to be part of that standard, then companies are just going to move to another country that hasn't signed up. Isn't that the problem?
That's exactly right. Vanuatu, for example, hasn't signed up. Panama had signed up and then they dropped out. The important thing in that standard is to move towards what's called automatic exchange of information. Up to now, with a lot of these countries, the exchange of information has been on request. And part of the problem there is that unless you know there's an entity there, you don't know what to ask about.
And in the media, there's been almost a name and shame kind of campaign against certain companies to encourage them to actually be more responsible in that particular country and pay their fair share. And here in Australia, we know that tax avoidance is worth about approximately $1.5 billion US every single year. That's money that we're missing out on.
Yep.
Do you think perhaps we can have some rules that say, if you don't pay your tax or if you use tax avoidance strategies, then we'll publish a list of those companies every year?
I'm not so sure whether the sort of name and shame will work or not, or whether it's a good idea. There is going to be some public disclosure, of which is already starting to happen, of major companies' tax affairs or how much tax they pay.
For example, you could make a law that says unless, as a company, you've agreed to some international standards that you can't operate in this country. We could do that, couldn't we?
We could, but that gets into questions about whether you want that sort of investment or not, I suppose. One of the things that would be argued there is that, let's say, some of the high-tech media companies or internet-based companies and so on do have economic activity here, and even if they're not paying much tax, there's economic activity. That's the sort of argument that can be run. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with it. The US has, for US companies, a thing called an alternative minimum tax. You could possibly go down that sort of route. It would also be possible globally to have some sort of notion of a minimum tax in particular jurisdictions or something like that. That, you know, there's a lot of ideas floating around on how to deal with these problems. It's just that no one has the total solution to any of them, I think.
Do you think we need a global tax framework rather than a voluntary common reporting standard?
Some people think about having a global tax authority. I mean, that's a long way off, I think. But some of the sort of options that have been looked at in the past have been to tax multinationals on some sort of global formulary apportionment basis. That's one option.
What would that look like?
Yeah, some of the US states do that, for example, and they look at the global profit of, say, Microsoft, and they say, well, what's your wages bill in California? How many assets do you have here? What's your turnover? And they'll say, well, therefore, X percentage of your global profit is California, and we'll tax it. The problem with those sort of formulas is that the economic circumstances, even of states within the United States, differ. So if you've got a lot of employees in a state, they tend to increase the number of percentage of value of payroll in the formula. And when you do that internationally, you get all these huge disparities in sub-Saharan African countries compared to, say, Nordic countries or what have you. So it tends to be difficult to work out a way that would be fair for everybody. It's sort of one of these areas where you can see where a lot of the problems are, but finding neat solutions is much more difficult.
That's Professor John Taylor. He's head of the School of Taxation and Business Law at the University of New South Wales. Well, on the show tonight, we have heard the Committee for Economic Development of Australia say that returning to a budget surplus is super important. But we're going to examine some other views next week on the show to find out exactly how important other experts say that is in the current context. We're also going to be looking at calls for a royal commission into the big banks. What is the culture of those big banks, the big four? And can it be shaken up by a royal commission? That's all coming up on the show next week. Thanks to our producers for this week, Andrew Barclay and Callum Morgan. You can find all of our shows at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter as well. Look for @onthemoney2ser. I'm Catherine Zengara. Thanks for your company.